So that's a sample, and that is what is remarkable about him. He was not just able to do the economics, but he really communicated it, and the book Free to Choose was a huge bestseller. And this is what I try to do on television. I mean, he did both. I'm just a TV simpleton trying to pass on his ideas. As I read about Milton, what is remarkable is how he could cross into both worlds. And in the current issue of Reason magazine, they have a number of quotes from Milton, some of which I'd like to read, and they really illustrate how he would say things much more simply than most of us do. A state law requiring people who ride motorcycles to wear helmets is the best litmus paper to distinguish true believers and individualism, because the person riding the motorcycle is risking only his own life. He may be a fool to drive that motorcycle without a helmet, but part of freedom is the freedom to be a fool. Many people complain about government waste, but I welcome it. Waste brings home to the public at large the fact that government is not an efficient instrument for achieving its objectives. One of the great causes for hope is the growing disillusionment with the idea that government's the all-wise, all-powerful big brother who can solve every problem. This, in some ways, makes me nervous about the fall of the Soviet Union. We no longer have wonderful models for failure that are so glaringly obvious. We have North Korea, Cuba, the Motor Vehicles Department. We need models, of course, because the mainstream media is so hostile. Paul earlier talked about how Capitalism and Freedom was not reviewed when it first came out by any of the mainstream media. It actually was never reviewed, according to Milton Friedman, who in 1987 wrote, "Capitalism and Freedom was a book directed at the general public that was destined to sell more than 400,000 copies in the next 18 years, written by an established professor at a leading university, published by a leading university press, yet it was not reviewed by a single popular American publication." I mean, I complain now that I've had two bestsellers and the New York Times won't mention one, but the climate was so much more hostile for Milton Friedman, and he cheerfully went on about it. Bill said something like, it's very important to not impugn the motives of these people, but that's very hard to resist. I impugn their motives all the time. And we live among them here in New York. And why are they so hostile? Milton wrote, "I think a major reason why intellectuals tend to move toward collectivism is that the collectivist answer is a simple one. If there's something wrong, pass a law to do something about it." And that is the way people think. You would think intellectuals would know better, but I guess you need to read Hayek and Friedman to understand that the spontaneous order can work better, or at least study economics. Milton also went on to say, it's fortunate that the capitalist society is more productive, because if it were not, it would never be tolerated. The bias against it is so great that it's got to have a 5-to-1 advantage in order to survive. And how true is that? That's demonstrated over and over. Look at the success Jose talked about in Chile, taking it from third world poverty to first world. And yet, after 10 years after this huge success of private Social Security accounts, the New York Times is still writing hostile stories, as one of the questioners mentioned. But about 10 years after I went to Chile and I tried to talk to people, I was trying to explain Social Security privatization before President Bush talked about it. And I thought I could get success stories from enthusiastic people on the street. But I couldn't. Everybody I talked to said, yeah, it's okay, but so-and-so's earning more interest than I am, and the paperwork is bothering me. That people take the benefits of capitalism, the wealth, for granted. And it's a reason it is an endless battle to explain this to people. In New Zealand, they had free market reforms that lifted the country out of a horrible stagnation, and a few years later, they voted the collectivists back in. Milton wrote, no, one before that. What is this hostility toward capitalism? I've tried to understand it among the intellectuals in New York City at the New York Times. Is part of it just the envy of the wealth? And certainly the unequal distribution of the wealth makes people uncomfortable. It seems unfair. But if you think about the kings and queens of England, they were absurdly wealthy, and yet they were liked, and people hated the bourgeoisie, not the kings and queens. They hated the people who sold them the very things they needed to make their lives better. There's something instinctive about this fear and hatred of capitalism. Perhaps it's the belief that when somebody sold them something, that they were taking something from them, the belief that business is a zero-sum game. It's what Gordon Gekko said in the movie Wall Street. It's a zero-sum game. He wins, I lose. And I understand why lawyers and politicians think this way, because if one lawyer wins, somebody else loses. Same way with politicians running for elections. But as study of economics has taught us, business is not a zero-sum game. It's not like somebody eats part of the pie and that means we have that much less. Business bakes whole new pies. Business is win-win. But the intellectuals don't get that. Capitalism, which has lifted more people out of the mud and misery than any system ever, continues to be vilified despite the cheerfulness of Milton Friedman. Now the new movement is that, okay, it brings us material stuff, but it corrupts our spirit. Again, Milton Friedman was clear and ahead of us. He wrote, "The argument has always been made that the trouble with capitalism is that it's materialistic, while collectivism can afford to pay attention to the non-material. But the experience has been the opposite. There are no societies that have embraced the purely material requisites of well-being as much as the collectivist. It is in the free societies that there have been a far greater development of the non-material, spiritual, artistic aspects of well-being." Once again, he is well ahead of us. So I try to communicate his ideas in my TV programs, in between doing stories on diet and breast enlargement, to keep my job. One of the ones that we did to try to explain his ideas was one we called "Is America Number One?" to try to discuss what makes a country prosperous. And if you ask high school kids, why is America prosperous when so many other countries are poor, they say things like, well, we have all these natural resources. So I say, well, India has equal natural resources and India's poor. And they say, well, India's overpopulated. And I can point out, well, actually, the population density of India is the same as that of New Jersey. New Jersey's doing okay. Or Hong Kong. Take Hong Kong, which has 20 times as many people per square foot as India, and Hong Kong has become rich. What's the difference? It's economic freedom. And this, of course, came from Free to Choose and Milton Friedman, and we have a short clip of this to illustrate what he taught me.
Economic freedom has allowed millions of poor people to become middle class. In fact, the average income here
is
almost equal to that in the United States. And it's higher than that in many of the world's richest countries.
Not as high as America's, 27,000, but almost, and higher than Australia, Italy, Great Britain, and Canada.
It's amazing how quickly all this has happened. 20 years ago, none of this was here. 50 years ago, this was just another desperately poor Asian community.
Hong Kong should teach us all a lesson on how to make everyone's life better, says Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman.
I was in Hong Kong in the 1950s, and you would never have wanted to live there. I saw the open shacks in which the refugees who were coming over were living. But they had the one key ingredient, freedom.
Freedom. Now, when people say freedom, I usually think of democracy, freedom to elect your representatives. But democracy alone doesn't make a country prosper.
Hong Kong's never had democracy. First, they had the Chinese emperor, then the British rulers, now the Chinese communists. But Hong Kong's prospering because for years the British governor governed under a policy best described as benevolent neglect.
By neglect, people mean the government didn't do much. Well, it built roads and schools, and the police and courts enforced simple and understandable laws against murder and theft. People knew that if they created something, it couldn't just be taken from them. But that was about it. No Federal Trade Commission, no OSHA, no labor laws or minimum wage for local workers. The British rulers basically sat around and drank tea. In Calcutta, to start a business, you first have to go to this big building to get government permission. Even New York City's licensing rules are simple compared to this maze. You fill out form after form after form, and then you wait and wait for days or years. Well, the bureaucrats debate the merits of your application. It's all well-intended, rules to make sure the food's clean, that the building's safe. But the result is that so many good ideas die as forms bundled and stacked on shelves, already cluttered with bundles from other people who are waiting. These are all regulations designed to make life safer and better.
Absolutely, absolutely. There is nothing that does so much harm has good intentions. The problem is that Indians can do well everywhere except in India. They do so badly because they're not allowed to use their own abilities within India. The government tells them what to do.
But wait a second. Is it that simple? Maybe they and others succeed in America because of our great natural advantage, our fabulous resources. We do have a lot. Maybe that's why we've done so well.
But again, look at Hong Kong. The island is just a rock. It had no natural resources to speak of, no good farming land, no oil, not even enough drinking water. Yet still, millions of people came here to this rock and created all this.
It's a phenomenal thing. It's hard to believe. Here's a rock, nothing, a great harbor. And on this rock, people can produce for themselves a higher standard of living than they can produce in Britain with its centuries of history. Incredible.
Because of freedom.
Because of freedom, absolutely because of freedom.
Thank you. That piece is now in most of America's high schools, thanks to a charity that some of you have supported, and ABC recently killed it. Andrea Rich and I are beginning to resurrect it and get more of these ideas into high schools. Christina Kendall, if you would stand up, she is also working with us. If any of you want to help with that, please, I'd like to get kids to think about this. And Christy initiated the last interview that Milton did before he died, which we did with him. I don't have a clip of it here, but it was for a story on price gouging. In praise of price gouging that we did after Hurricane Katrina. And after the hurricane, some guy from Tennessee drove 600 miles to Mississippi after watching people struggle to get power. And he bought 20 generators, put them in his truck, drove there, started selling them. People were eager to buy them. The police quickly showed up and locked him up and locked up his generators, where they still are to this day. And I was trying to make the point that these price gouging rules, all well-intended, as Milton said, hurt people more than they help. And it's only through price gouging, through sudden price spikes, that suppliers rush in to bring us the things we want most. Why would you leave your home in Tennessee to bring people generators unless you could make some extra profit? And the people for whom I work said, this can't be true, and you can't just say this. And I said, how about if I get three Nobel Prize-winning economists to say it's true? So I rounded up bites from three, and two, of course, were unintelligible. But Milton, God bless him, always makes it clear, and he said, the price gougers are heroes! So we will all miss him. Paul talked about his optimism, and I always thought of him as a very optimistic man. He certainly is more optimistic than I. But then reading these quotes, I see that in some ways his optimism was tempered. He said, there have been a few victories. We did, after all, get rid of the civil aeronautics board. We did get rid of military conscription. That's something to celebrate. But the improvement has been meager. Another time he said, there is a great deal of basis for believing that a free society is fundamentally unstable. We've got to face the facts. I think it's the utmost of naivete to suppose that a free society is somehow the natural order of things. I think the odds are that a free society is on the way out. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't fight for it, or that sulking in our tents, explaining to one another how nice it would be if we could only get our way, is an effective means of fighting for a free society. So he fought. I thank you for continuing the fight, and we all need to keep fighting. Thank you very much.